Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thank you, Marshall, and welcome to Off Script. Luigi Pirandello. It's not a name readily known to even the most regular theatergoers. He was an Italian dramatist, novelist, poet, and short story writer who was awarded the 1935 Nobel Prize in Literature. He's best known for his plays, the best known probably Six Characters in Search of an Author and The Rules of the Game. One of his lesser-known plays, Naked, written in 1922, is really, really rarely performed, but right now it's on stage at the Unicorn Stage at the Berkshire Theatre Festival in Stockbridge through October 28th in an adaptation of it that first premiered in London nearly 20 years ago. My guest today is Eric Hill, the director of Naked, who is well known to Berkshire audiences for his productions of the works of serious dramatists like Edward Albee, Samuel Beckett, Harold Pinter, and now Pirandello himself. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, Dan. Can you hear me all right?
We can hear you just fine. Congratulations on the play. I just saw it last night, and it's a really convoluted story. It's a tricky play by any measure. And before we get into so I want to say congratulations because
Thank
it's
you.
A wonderful production. Before we get into the details about the production and the themes of this play, which are really relevant today. Could you sketch out for people who don't know the story at all who the main character is and what is the premise of the conflict that she faces?
The main character is a woman named Ursilia, and she has been a nanny for an ambassador from Italy to a remote area called in a place called Smyrna, which is in Anatolia, it was sort of an Italian outpost at that time. She'd had an affair with the young lieutenant there. She'd also had an affair with the ambassador himself, she has some incidents in her past which she tries to escape from and comes to Rome, where the play is set, in the home of an author who has brought her in to give her shelter and who encounters the full measure of what it is that's going on in her life. That's the basic premise of the story. There's a mystery involved in it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different complications that arise. But basically, it's a story about a woman with the past that follows her to Rome and about how the men who surround her create a situation in which she is forced into an identity or a lack of identity that is in some ways transformational and even devastating.
Right. So you've got the novelist who wants to basically take her story and write a novel about it. You've got a reporter who's just reported what he's told her. You've got the former lover who's a diplomat, and you've got a former lover that she once intended to marry. And then you've also got a housekeeper who's or the owner of the apartment building. What struck me about it is it's about her story, but each one of these men particularly, plus even the woman who owns the apartment, wants to superimpose and sometimes even appropriate their story on top of hers. Did I pick that up right?
That's correct, yeah. I think that's the whole nature of Pirandello in a way. If you think of this play in a certain way, it's one character in search of an author as opposed to six.
Right.
She's looking for someone to write what she wants to be her story. And I think, unfortunately, what we see being written is a story of a woman who is played upon by all the men in her life, in order that they might achieve some kind of imagined sexual fulfillment, some kind of power or control over her, or some self-image that they're interested in maintaining at the expense of her lack of any self-image, being a victim in this situation who is forced to the actions that she takes.
We've got a lot of major characters to talk about besides Ercilia. But what struck me was when the novelist takes Ercilia home to his apartment. He wants to write a novel about her, and he's they're confronted by the woman who owns the apartment, and she turns around to another woman, to Ercilia, and describes her as, and I'm quoting, a disgusting object. That just really threw me. This is a woman talking about a woman, and without getting into what role is that minor character? Is she sort of like,
that's the widow. She owns the apartment.
Is she sort of like a John Q. Public? Because later in the play, what happens is that she's disgusted by the object, but this woman whom she describes as an object. But later on, when she realizes this woman's a celebrity, all of a sudden she's interested in her, and there's a cachet to having her around the house.
Yeah, correct. And I think Birandello is trying to tell you something there. Just to be clear, the author, Nota, Lodovico Nota, he brought her home from the hospital where she's been recovering from an attempted suicide in a public park. His intentions are not altogether honorable for the early part of the play until she makes it clear that that's not what she's interested in, but that she is interested in him writing a story about her, something that he takes on with interest more and more as he follows his, I think, unrelenting course of still trying to get her to stay there and be with him. But yes, his intentions at first are not just purely artistic.
Right, right. In case you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. My guest today is Eric Hill. He's the director up at Berkshire Theater Festival, and he's put together a marvelous production of Luigi Pirandello's Naked, rarely staged anywhere in the world these days, and that runs through October 28th. I stayed around last night after the production for a talkback that was really quite remarkable, as talkbacks go, especially. And you talked about putting this cast together and how this – you could not have realized the success of this production without really knowing your cast as well as you do already. Can you talk about that?
That's an essential ingredient here. The nature of Pirandello and actually the nature of a lot of the playwrights I've been directing lately require not just the really basic fundamental skills that most American actors possess, strongly possess, which is a sort of capacity to act in a realistic play with naturalistic techniques that are rich and colorful. All these actors are capable of that, but these actors are capable of another gear, if you will. They're able to do something else, and there are playwrights that require something else, that ask you to go to a place that the naturalist methodology may offer a base for you, but you're heading into other territory. And there has to be given a reason what that territory is there for, why we're going into it, what kind of energy it requires to pull off what you're trying to do theatrically. And I always learn to come back to the playwright, in this case Pirandello, who himself has gone to the melodramatic form in order to point up the specific things that he's probably trying to say about the nature of illusion and reality and truth versus lies or illusion.
Right.
All of those things are very much at home in the theater, a place where illusion is actually quite comfortable, and therefore he is making full use of those techniques, not just in a kind of setting, but within the actors themselves, and causing them to perform in a way in which they reflect the shifting identities, shifting masks, if you will, as one audience member last night accurately quoted, and to watch them do that, and to watch them do that in the telling of a story which has an enormously complicated plot, and to keep all of those twists and turns alive, in the moment and fun at times. I mean, it's not just a a heavy story about sexual abuse. It's a story that is told in a very fascinatingly theatrical way with a lot of humor, and I think with a lot of insight and interest that adds to the mystery and the melodramatic qualities of the play.
Two questions. For the general audience, because this word is kicked around so frequently and it's part of the vernacular to describe a lot of stuff, when you're talking theater critically, as you are, mm-hmm. define melodrama as opposed to drama.
Right. Melodrama has in the name itself, a mellow added in front of drama, that here implies a kind of the use of, I guess, melody that is heightened. The name itself implies a heightened form of drama, a kind of, I think the terminology we use sometimes is called potboiler, uh-huh. if you will, that the temperature runs high the whole time. That there is something afoot the whole time. Something is being pursued actively and aggressively and sometimes to absurd degrees, and all done so in the context of something of a looming mystery or some kind of hidden secret that is revealed through the course of the telling of the story.
Right. But you also mentioned that this isn't always melodramatic. I mean, there's some real, mm-hmm. there's real tragedy in this, but there's some yeah. really comedic aspects of it. One of the yeah. actors observed in the talkback last night that there are elements of commedia dell'arte in this. And I wanted to ask you about James Barry's performance, who plays the mm-hmm. young lover. At points, he's almost clownish in his approach, which is – and it physically clownish, not just – laughing. He's bouncing around the stage. At one point, he's down on all fours, I think.
He's not the only character, huh?
Well, yeah, you got the diplomat too, I think.
And her.
And she too. So how do you keep all of those things in balance so that it doesn't really drip into farce, that it really doesn't steer over into total absurdity? And as you say, if you're playing it for melodrama, that it maintains a constant set of mystery that drives the narrative?
Well, I have learned each time out in recent challenges against some of the most formidable playwrights that we have in the canon, that your best recourse is to allow the playwright to show you exactly how to do just what you described. And if you're careful and listening to the playwright and watching the playwright, he's aware of all of these things too. He was a man of the theater. He produced this play. He knows how it works. And he chose this form of melodrama in particular to show up the human spirit in all kinds of shapes, forms, ages, situations related to this woman. And he is one aspect of that. And yeah, it takes on comedic aspects and I think commedia dell'arte was certainly in his mind. He's not the only one. I think several of them reached that proportion. But nonetheless, I keep it in balance mostly by just keeping my head inside of what the playwright wants and what the playwright's trying to achieve in a given moment, and then let it go and move on to the next thing, and it finds its own proportion. The other thing is that that's an extremely hard role to play. Because it's written the way, he's doing it. And when you attack that, it's very, very difficult to create modulation within that is, in this case, comedic rather than just being combative. And I think there's a fine line between those two. And having worked with James for a long time and knowing him well and being able to work very closely with a very brave actor doing, a pretty remarkable thing, I think that's really very, very crucial. Again, it comes back to company and working closely with the actors that I know. You don't attack a play like this without that. You'd be in difficult straits.
Right. And I think we can mention that Tara Franklin, who's well known to Berkshire Theatre audiences, was in your Zeus story last year and 2 years ago, The Homecoming as Ruth, is actually the real-life spouse of James Barry.
Yeah, and both of them are my students. I knew them back when James was 18, and I knew Tara since she was 21. and we've been working together ever since. They're sort of the cream of the crop of the many students that I've taught over the years, and they've evolved with me and now live in this neck of the woods, and we continue to work together. And so we've had a long-standing relationship and the ability to get to know one another, and I trained them, so if they don't do things the right way, I have only myself to blame.
Okay. Let's mention a couple of other members of the cast. Rocco Sisto, who played a lead role in Homecoming a couple of years, is back. He plays the novelist Nota. And, of course, David Atkins, who's well-known to Berkshire Theater audiences, plays the Italian reporter who puts her out in the public to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
You've got two other new actor into the troupe, Jeffrey Dornbus. Is he new to Berkshire Theatre Group? Had you worked with him before?
He is. No, he's new to the Berkshire Theatre Group, yeah.
Now, the scene, talking about him, when you talked about the comedic aspects of this, almost the clownish aspects with the character of Franco, the scene where the diplomat comes back to confront his former lover, Acilia. Opening of Act Two, there is no apology whatsoever for a full frontal use of the C word. That elicited some gasp from the audience.
Yeah.
Even in an age when, if you go on HBO and you're watching The Deuce or any of these, binge-worthy, miniseries, it's become almost a common word. But I haven't seen an audience gasp in a long time. Did you expect that kind of reaction?
Did you play
the scene to get that reaction?
No.
No. Okay. All right.
No.
Okay. Moving into the scene that really grips, I think, the audience is when the former lover, the diplomat, seeks physical revenge on the chaise with Ercilia.
Yeah.
And you have him approach her, confront her, hold her in a chokehold from the rear. It's really a provocative, really provocative scene. You read a play, you're the director, you could see that play in a lot of – I presume that the way you directed that is not in Pirandello's stage direction.
He doesn't have any stage direction.
So where did that come from, Eric?
Well, from what he's saying, from what Pirandello has the man saying, what he's talking about in this particular instance when he's seen her make her confessional about the death of the baby and how guilty she really actually does feel about it, she collapses in a heap, and he goes on to talk about the nature of his life and what it was like and how he thought he was doing everything for everybody else until she came along, and he thought even with her he was trying to do the right thing by hooking her up with this other guy, but he realized along the way that it wasn't any of that, that it was all completely him and his own desire, and that what she has ignited in him is an animal, and that's what he's saying to her, this animal that I've become, and do you know what you've done to me? And so in that moment, the highest of the high reveal themselves to be the lowest of the low in a very, very intimate moment where she is simply being sexually assaulted. Now, I'm not sure what Pirandello intended other than that, but that's where it came down for me. And by the way, that's not the only aggressive sexual moment in that scene. There are a couple.
Right.
That opening line, which you mentioned with the C word, which by the way in England is a much more common expression, and it's a British adaptation, which we've Americanized to some extent, but that word lands a lot harder in our culture than it does in that. There are other moments of physical engagement between the two, which I think are quite frank.
She goes for him. She goes after him where it really hurts.
That's because he's gone after her where it really hurts first.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's her whole point, which is if you do that to me, don't expect that I'm just the kind of woman who's going to sit here and take it. And then they wrangle for a while, and finally she says, okay, yeah, I'll take it. I'll take whatever you want. We'll do whatever you want. She shows herself completely powerless, ultimately, to affect the change that it would be required to have the ending that she requires. In the meantime, she has to do what the men around her say.
Mm-hmm. which is going to lead us into a discussion of why this play is relevant now. But I've got to remind everybody you're listening to Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. The guest today, Eric Hill, the director of Luigi Pirandello's Naked, now splendidly staged at the Unicorn up in Stockbridge on through October 28th. You mentioned just something a couple of minutes ago about how this play presents, in this case, in the character of the diplomat, the highest of the high behaving like the lowest of the low. If that isn't a segue into why you might have selected this play to be produced at this time, I don't know what is, but how did this play get on the schedule at Berkshire?
Well, you know, this is I would like to say that you know, we're all geniuses here and we picked this right at the right time because we knew all this was going to happen, but not the case. Kate McGuire, our artistic director, and my wife has been looking at this play for a long time. The issue is something that's been on her plate for a long time. I think she saw it as part of a composite in a season that really touches a lot of bases that are culturally relevant at the moment. This was one of them. So I think if you look at it in the broader context, we can simply say that we were exceedingly fortunate through the misfortune of others to have allowed this to happen at this time when the issue is so hot on everybody's plate. That said, I think this issue is hot on everybody's plate anyway, all the time. No matter when we would have presented it, I think we would have gotten something close to the reaction we're getting right now, for the simple reason that I don't think people see this topic sent at them in this particular form. And that is, I can't emphasize that enough. It's live. It's a melodrama. It's actors acting at a level of energy that we don't normally see in a way that we don't are not accustomed to watching, and it's really fascinating. And the result is revealing in a way that talks about a subject we're all dealing with, but this deals with it in a different kind of way and one that gives us a new angle on it.
There's also the element of the whole concept of illusion and reality. I mean, and the parallax, the point of view, who's, you know, in some ways, and I don't want to sound trite about this, but looking at the production in one way, a subtitle could almost be whose story is this anyway, or whose life is this anyway? Because I keep getting back to how all these guys want to appropriate her tragedy for their own ends.
Right.
Also, yep. There were a woman in front of me. There's one marvelous scene among the many in this, where the I think the reporter and the novelist are having an argument about who's going to really get the story right, and the woman in front of me says fake news. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about that a little bit? I mean, when you picked up the play and read it for the first time in preparation of this, did that sub-theme come out?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think you go through the first act of this play and people come in, they go out, and a lot of things we're led to think, oh, gee, should I be thinking about, you know, sexual abuse, or should I be thinking about journalism, or should I be thinking about the artist, or should I be thinking about the mess out in the street outside the window? I mean, there's a lot of things that you're led to think about, and that's one of them, certainly. But in terms of being, you know, a play that becomes ultimately about journalism in any other way than once it's put in print and a lot of people read it, reality changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that reality change affects the way we all behave and the way that we respond. So what we thought maybe was true one day, if we read it in the newspaper, we now no longer think that's true. We think something else is true, and we react accordingly, or vice versa. And that the obscure are now made famous, right?
Right.
That just exactly what's happened with our friend Dr. Ford, once a sort of, you know, I think very content, well, not content, obviously, but filled with, a woman filled with anxiety, but she had a life and a good life, and now she's a public figure and belongs to American history, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that's a very disarming feeling. That whole sense of being propelled from your own life into a larger arena where everybody is looking at you is a very, very frightening and, I think, transformational kind of experience. And I think that's what the journalist represents here. And not only that, Pirandello is very careful to show you that He's not a kind of neutral thinker at all. He's a guy who's interested in what's going to make his story sound the most exciting so he can get the most attention. And he even at one point says to her, I wrote what I felt. You know, I felt sorry for you. Well, that's really not what journalists are supposed to do. They're supposed to write about the facts as they understand them. So even in that, I think Pirandello is jabbing at journalism and showing you the difference between journalism and real fictional writing, which I think is one of the issues that's front and center. So, yeah, it's that idea is there among many.
Let's get to the central idea, and we're going to wrap it up. I'd like to have you comment on, because writers don't choose titles of plays by accident. By Italian translation, I think, the original title of this play is Clothing the Naked, and that does relate to the final scene in this fabulous monologue that the heroine has. But tell us why naked, and what is Pirandello saying about naked in this story?
I think what Pirandello's ultimate message here is that we can cloak ourselves in whatever mask, full-body mask that we want to, but ultimately time will reveal us to be what we really are, which is naked. And in that sense, we're not talking just literal form, but we're talking about spiritually naked. That is, possessing no real internal reality, that we are simply operating on an illusion, and that without our uniform or our fancy dress to make us look like we're part of a society level that we associate with, or our role in the society, whatever, when those things are taken away, when they're stripped away and just the person is left alone, then they are truly naked, in the sense that she is naked because not only she had all of that taken away from her before the get-go, but since that she's experienced degradation, humiliation, rejection, false publicity, you name it, she's gotten it. And so I think that it goes beyond in that case. And I think that's really where we are today. And I think that's ultimately the discussion of Pirandello and the current time. That's where that intersects.
And to see that discussion really wondrously theatricalized, I would encourage everybody to get up to the Unicorn Theater by October 28th and see Eric Hill's direction of this wonderful adaptation of Pirandello's Naked. Eric, thank you very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
And congratulations again. And thank you all for listening to Off Script. As you know, it's underwritten by Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut. Please listen in again next week. And until you do, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.